From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. SEC football coaches weighed in this week, or didn't, on the controversy surrounding the Confederate flag. In this week's Three Things You Should Know, we'll tell you who said what. We'll also debate what happens to the sports we love if, or perhaps when, college players begin to get paid, and we'll consider whether the MLB All-Star Game should be permanently benched. Also ahead on Only a Game, the history of the Stadium Classic, Who Let the Dogs Out? Also ahead, a longtime sports reporter returns to the site of her former paper route to help save her hometown daily.
My interest in news goes back to that. You know, when I was delivering the papers, and I would just pull a paper out of my bag and read it going from house to house.
Stay tuned. It's been said that the days following Major League Baseball's All-Star Game are the quietest on the sports calendar. For a brief moment, there are no MLB, NBA, NFL, or NHL games to watch, but there are still three stories you should know. This week's edition enables me to welcome Pat Forty, National College columnist for Yahoo Sports, back to the program. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Bill. Happy to be on with you.
And we're joined by another old friend of the show, Patrick Ruby, contributing editor of Vice Sports. Welcome back, Patrick.
Great to be here and great to be in the old friend status.
Patrick, you're first up. What's the story that you want to make sure our listeners hear this week?
So here's something people aren't paying attention to. We all remember the Ed O'Bannon federal antitrust lawsuit against the NCAA. In the ruling, it's going to allow schools to pay football and men's basketball players for the use of their names, images, and likenesses. Every academic year, schools are going to be able to offer athletes at least $5,000 that goes into a trust fund that they can then access when they're out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing people don't realize. This is all set to go into effect on August 1st. So all players enrolling in school after July 1st of next year, they're going to be eligible for this. So basically, all these recruits, we're going to see schools actually be allowed to make somewhat competitive offers to them. Now, the NCAA has appealed the O'Bannon ruling as a whole. That could change things. But it's much more likely that that won't happen and that this thing is going to become real in a couple of weeks. And I think ultimately, it's going to be very bad for the NCAA's amateurism-based business model, but not in the way the NCAA claims. As everybody knows, the NCAA's big argument at this point for keeping things the way it is to say, here comes a parade of horribles. Well, look, there just isn't enough money. Even though we're a multi-billion dollar industry, there just isn't enough money. Women's sports are going to get cut. Non-revenue sports are going to get cut. America's going to lose at the Olympics. Cats and dogs are going to live together. The list just goes on and on. But here's what I think is going to happen with this injunction, why it's so clever by the federal judge that put it in. Nothing. Nothing's going to happen. Schools that want to pay a little bit more to have better players because winning matters to them, they're going to do that. The same way they do that now with the coaches, the same way they do it with fancier weight rooms. The schools that don't or can't, they won't. The sports we all love, they're going to stay exactly the same. A little more money is going to go to the players. A little less money is going to go to the administrators and having, you know, Corinthian leather couches in like the locker rooms and the players' lounges.
Pat Forty, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I'm pleased to hear it's not going to be the fall of the Republic when this goes into effect. And Patrick has been among the leading firebrands on this issue for quite some time. And I think it has helped sway public opinion to a degree that the NCAA should be paying players and that players should be getting more than they have gotten historically. And I agree with that. My question, though, I still wonder if this is a slippery slope towards some things that a lot of people aren't quite ready for. For one thing, if there's going to be, lack of a better term, bidding for players, when are players going to be able to have agent representation? I know when agents get involved now, when players are 17, 18, do we want agents involved when they're 15, 16, when the recruiting process starts? I do wonder how many non-revenue sports are going to be suffering in this whole thing. If Patrick's scenario plays out the way he laid it out, then that's awesome. But I do think there's going to be some ancillary effects that maybe people aren't ready for.
I can't believe how radical both of you are. I can't believe either of you are serious. The lads will no longer be playing for the glory of the red and gray or the blue and gold or whatever. College football and basketball will be no more than an arena in which mercenaries do battle. What of tradition? What of fuzzy mascots? The next thing you know, fans will be betting on these contests.
Get my fainting couch. I think I have the vapors. I just want to add, you know, Pat brings up a really good point about agents and sort of what kind of problems might get caused by going to essentially a market economy. I think that's a really important thing. And as much as I've bashed the NCAA and its overregulation of amateurism and its sort of a Keystone Cops pursuit of enforcing it, I could imagine a future where you take all these NCAA current compliance departments, a lot of actually good people that work in them, and you say, look, we're not going to regulate people getting paid, but we are going to try to regulate agents. We're going to try to actually protect players, not from money, but from getting ripped off. Mm-hmm. That would be quite a concept for the NCAA and its member schools.
All right, I'm going to move on to my story, and it begins with a number, because baseball is allegedly all about numbers. From 1959 to 1962, and I remember this, Major League Baseball staged two All-Star games. The idea was to generate money for the players' pension fund, and some of the money might actually have gone there. Tuesday night's MLB All-Star game drew the lowest ratings ever, 6.6. The previous low was 6.8 back in 2012. Two All-Star games was silly, and one, maybe one too many. I think we should end the embarrassment, give all the players, not just the ones who aren't All-Stars, a few days off in July. Former Commissioner Selig's goofy idea that he could revitalize the All-Star game by having home field advantage in the World Series hinge on it has not worked. Interleague play gives fans lots of opportunities to see the stars from both leagues play during the regular season. Shut the All-Star game down. What do you think?
I have no problem with that. I used to be an All-Star game lover back in the day, and I will say that was news to me that there were two All-Star games once upon a time. So you scooped me there. But
first time for everything.
I get nothing out of the All-Star game now, and I don't get the feeling very many other people do. As you said, interleague play has really kind of changed that, and all of the ancillary activities that come along with the All-Star game bore me. It's bad when the ESPYs are actually more interesting than the All-Star game.
Then we went there.
Patrick, are you gonna stand up for the Midsummer Classic?
I am, but in a limited way. Even if the ratings are low, if baseball can make money off of this game, you know, if it's still working within their business model, I can't really fault them for doing it just because I don't want to watch. But that said, I definitely don't want to watch. And if it went away, and since I'm not making a piece of the action on it, I personally really wouldn't care.
All right, Pat, what's your story?
My story, I was at the SEC football media days this week, and I found out that the most uncomfortable position a college football coach can be in the South, and it's not being down by three touchdowns in the fourth quarter. It is having a reporter ask him in front of a ballroom of people his opinion of the Confederate flag, especially if he is in a state such as South Carolina or Mississippi that has had the flag at the state capitol. And you want to watch a bunch of coaches start sweating and pulling at their collar and trying to navigate their way through a namby-pamby answer to the question, that's what transpired. Thank goodness, again, for Steve Spurrier for just coming flat out saying, I'm so glad we got rid of the Confederate flag. Thank goodness that he was willing to speak his mind about this and have an open conscience about it. But it was amazing to me. Mississippi State's Dan Mullen tiptoed around it. Mississippi's Hugh Freeze trotted out this line that, you know, the Confederate flag stood for something else, but it has been hijacked by people with ill will. Wait a minute, guys. This is an issue where I think it's perfectly fine to ask a football coach his opinion on this. These are influential people within their universities, within their states, and they happen to recruit a whole lot of African Americans from the South. So they better have an informed opinion on it, and they better be unafraid to say what their opinion is. So maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was a little bit disappointed at the lack of forthrightness and a hard line, basically, from these football coaches when they were asked these questions.
Either, like you said, either they're just trying to be evasive. They're basically like, oh, my God, I got asked a political question. What do I do? here are some words. Hopefully they mean nothing by the time I'm finished saying them and you'll ask somebody else. But the other part that struck me was that if that's not the case, then these coaches actually seem really ill-informed. Like they never took a history class. Look, I know football is all consuming. And I know if you're an SEC football coach, you're probably thinking football, if not 24/7, 22/7. But you know, it's basic American history. You know, the Confederacy was fighting for essentially a republic of racial slavery. It's not that complicated. And that is their battle flag. And we're still in America living and dealing with all these years later, tons of cultural, political, social ramifications from that. The past is the present is the future in a lot of ways. Even if you're a football coach, you should have a little bit of basic historical literacy.
I thought it was interesting that Spurrier, 8 years ago, he not only said the flag needed to be eliminated, but he also said something about the position that coaches are in these days. He said, "I can't talk about political things, but if I could, I would say the flag needs to go." He's saying something about the whole circumstance.
He is. And that's, you know, I just don't want the coaches to feel like they have safe harbor from talking about this because they're football coaches. I think quite the opposite. I think they should feel duty bound to be informed and having a voice in this. And the other thing is just that we have in this country tried in some quarters to pretend racial issues don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Like we've moved past that. And the term post-racial, which I thought was complete bunk. And I'm afraid it took something as horrific as what happened in Charleston to remind a lot of people that, no, there's still a long way to go.
Pat, where does this particular discussion fall in terms of the larger matter of how often coaches at Southern universities have resisted change and how often they have actually functioned as leaders to some extent in bringing about change?
Very good question. The one shining example would be Dean Smith, who not only brought in Charlie Scott as the first African-American player at North Carolina in the 60s, but you know, it was part of a sit-in in North Carolina. I mean, was a very active person in terms of race relations. And I think, you know, there are some coaches that will stand up and will get involved in these sort of things, but far and large, the majority of them would very much prefer not to. And, you know, it's kind of a case of selective influence. They want to have a whole lot of influence where it's going to help their program specifically. But then if there's something of a larger issue, they want to say, hey, I'm just the football coach here.
And look, you're an American citizen before you're a football coach, no matter how much you get paid to be a football coach. Like, it's okay. It's encouraged to, like, be informed, to have an opinion, to have something to say on these things. I think too much in sports, we've gotten to that point of, like, I don't want to seem controversial because I don't want to have to deal with it on the news. I don't want to offend a sponsor, blah, blah, blah. Hopefully we can get away from that. But it would be nice, you know, as Pat is saying, these people who are actually in positions of authority and positions in some ways, even maybe a little bit of a moral authority, could actually wield it and use it.
Our roundtable participants this week have been Pat Forty of Yahoo Sports. Pat, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
And Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
If you dropped acid and decided to go make baseball, this is what you would end up with. That's how a Minnesota Twins scout described the popular Finnish sport of pesäpallo. The Wall Street Journal's Brian Costa was recently in Finland to report on the baseball-like game that packs more action and a lot more running than our national pastime. Brian, how does pesäpallo differ from baseball?
The biggest difference is the pitcher, instead of throwing the ball from a mound at the batter, stands beside him and throws it up in the air and sort of gets out of the way.
Ah.
But there are base paths, there's four bases, there's home plate, players field with gloves. So it's a little bit of just like baseball and nothing like baseball.
Critics of baseball in the U.S. say the games are too long, it's too slow, there's not enough action. Would such critics be happier with pesäpallo?
Oh, they would love pesäpallo. There are very, very few strikeouts, very few swings and misses. So pretty much every ball that gets pitched gets put into play.
Ah, so there is continuous action, I guess.
It is. And what it does is it keeps the fielders on their toes, because not only are they constantly chasing after balls put in play, but they're sort of swarming around in these different defensive formations. They did a study where they put a pedometer on a player a few years ago, and they found that the player ran 10.5 kilometers during the game, which
wow.
is more than Cristiano Ronaldo, the soccer star, averaged during Champions League matches this year.
What's it like for fans attending a game of Pesapolo, and how many are there? Is this a big popular attraction?
This is really not a city sport, so Helsinki, you won't see that much of it. But it is the sport of the Finnish countryside. You'll have towns where the local population may be 3,000 people, and they'll get 3,500 at a game. Someone there told me, you know, we don't go to church as much anymore here, so this is like that community coming together thing for us.
How was the sport invented? Because I'm assuming acid was not involved, never mind what that Minnesota twin scout said.
No, I don't think acid was involved. There was a Finnish Olympian track and field star back in the early 1900s, and he was visiting the U.S., and he went to a baseball game in Boston. And his reaction was almost about 100 years ahead of its time, which was to say, this is a really fascinating game, but it moves a little bit slow. So he went back to Finland and later created his own version, basically taking what American baseball already had and making whatever rules he saw fit.
You note that a scout from the New York Yankees was in Finland last month for All-Star Weekend there, and I assume he was looking for talent. Is it just a matter of time before Major League Baseball is flooded with Finns?
That may be quite a bit of time before they're flooded with Finns. Scouting in Europe, it's not exactly a rich treasure trove of future major leaguers, but I think when you're a scout there, you're just looking for great athletes that you think might have a chance of being developed into great baseball players.
Finnish players, I gather, do not seem very interested in playing baseball as we know it.
No, they're not. It's very interesting. There were a fair number of fans in the stands who had Yankees or Red Sox or Cubs or other MLB hats on, but none of them seemed to really follow Major League Baseball. The people who I asked about their impressions of it kind of smirked or winced or just said, yeah, you know, that. I mean, they feel like they've got a better version of it.
Brian Costa is a sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and you can link to his story, What Finland Can Teach America About Baseball, at onlyagame.org. Brian, thanks very much for speaking with me. It's been fun.
Thanks, Bill.
The big leagues have an allure that calls to athletes and reporters alike, but in our next story, Only a Game's Doug Trabue finds that sometimes the call of home is just as powerful.
For most of the 1980s, my family lived in a town called Fairlawn in New Jersey, and when I was about 10 years old, I got a paper route delivering the Bergen Record. It was my first job, and for a 10-year-old, it was good money. My route paid for a new bike and my first computer, a then-state-of-the-art Apple IIc. To this day, I can still remember the details of the route, the houses, the staircases I had to climb, the people who took a few weeks to pay their bills. Maureen Mullen remembers all the names of her paper route customers.
Shireta Pagano, Salzman Sacco, Rathbun, Kodatek, Walsh, Sims, Hovey, Rogerio Mazzola, Johansson.
Maureen delivered the daily item of Lynn here in her hometown, Lynn, Massachusetts. It's a rugged oceanside city north of Boston. We came back to her old neighborhood to walk her route.
My parents bought the house, I guess, in 1965, and it was supposed to be their starter house. But it was such a great neighborhood, and, you know, they ended up staying there. It was, you know, it was so much fun. If you ever wanted a game or anything, all you had to do was just walk out your front door, and there were just tons of kids to play with. But it's a little bittersweet being back here. This is the first time I've really been back since my father sold the house just almost a year ago. It still feels like home.
Maureen is one of four children, and the paper route was passed down from one kid to the next.
So today's a beautiful sunny day. It'd be a good day for delivering papers, but I also remember all the snowy days.
I still think my interest in news goes back to that. You know, when I was delivering the papers, and I would just pull a paper out of my bag and read it going from house to house.
Maureen loved sports growing up. She ran cross country and track, played baseball, fought to get a girls' soccer team at Lynn English High School. But she was just as passionate about getting a byline in the Daily Item. Every year, the paper selected some students to write a weekly column.
I actually applied to do that as a junior. And the guidance counselor said, no, you know, it's only for seniors. So I said, all right, well, I'm applying now for my senior year.
Maureen interned at the Daily Item during college in the 1980s, but her professional life didn't begin at a newspaper. She worked on educational videos. She moved to Florida, then Missouri. But when she landed a job she hated, she decided,
life is too short to not be enjoying your work.
So back in Massachusetts, Maureen started calling sports editors, and they started giving her assignments as a reporter. Before long, Maureen became a regular in the press box at Boston's Fenway Park, writing about baseball for the Boston Globe, USA Today, MLB.com. She built relationships, and her reputation grew. In 2007, during spring training in Florida, Red Sox designated hitter David Ortiz called her over to his locker. He wanted to tell her a story about a man he'd met at Fenway the previous summer.
Somehow he got connected to a soldier from New Hampshire who was going off to Iraq. The soldier, who was very young, early 20s, said to him, okay, hit a home run for me today. And David says, well, I don't know if I can do that, but I'll try. And not only was it a home run, it was a walk-off home run. You know, he heard from the kid later. The kid was thrilled, couldn't have been happier.
Ortiz hadn't heard anything more until that morning at spring training.
And that morning, David got a call telling him that the soldier had just been killed in Iraq. So I'm starting to get choked up telling you about it now. So as he's telling me the story, he's crying. He pulls a T-shirt out of his locker, and he's wiping his eyes with it. I've got a huge lump in my throat. I'm trying to be professional and not cry, and I've got tears in my eyes. And, you know, he knew that I would handle it the right way, and I wasn't going to sensationalize the story.
Writing about the major leagues and covering a couple of World Series didn't keep Maureen from taking smaller assignments over the past 15 years, including a few for the Lynn Daily Item.
I covered Little League opening days, too. You know, I always put that on my resume, from Little League opening days to, you know, World Series games. Oh, yeah, no, I've never thought of myself as, you know, too big for those things.
Last year, after 137 years of ownership by the same family, the Daily Item of Lynn went up for sale. Ted Grant, a former editor, organized a group of local investors who bought the paper in September. Grant knew Maureen, and he'd been following her career.
Anytime I saw a Maureen Mullen byline, I always read the story. Even if I wasn't particularly interested in the subject, I was interested in this kid from Lynn.
And within a couple of months, Grant offered her a job. Sports editor. For Maureen, the timing felt just right.
It had kind of been in the back of my mind about, you know, maybe it's time to do something different. So when this opportunity came up, I just sort of looked at it like, okay, that's karma telling me something there.
The problem of turning around a newspaper is a common one these days, but the Item has other challenges. Lynn is a city that's struggled with crime and a tough economy for decades. About 91,000 people live there. According to the U.S. Census Bureau data from 2013, more than one in five of the residents live below the poverty line.
Lynn has always had this, Lynn, city of sin thing.
Everyone around here knows the rest of the rhyme. Lynn, the city of sin, you never come out the way you came in.
It's an urban community, so of course it has its issues, like any other urban community does. But none of us are in it to make a killing. We're not silly enough to think that all of a sudden this is going to be worth a gazillion dollars. It's not. But what it can do is help a community.
I used to be an intern at a radio station right here on Exchange Street, right across from the Lynn Item building. It's a massive five-story structure. And when Maureen Mullen was a kid delivering the paper, it would have been a bustling spot. It housed the printing press and the huge staff that worked on the newspaper. Even later, in the mid-90s, the circulation was still about 30,000. Today, it's down to about 10,000.
The Item recently moved into a much smaller space a few blocks away. The staff's down to about 40 full-time people. Maureen Mullen understands the challenges, but she also knows that her section of the paper can do something rare in the modern media age. Connect with kids.
You know, I remember I played sports in high school, and I just remember how big a deal it was for me if I saw my name or my picture in the paper. And I try to keep that in mind, too, because with some of these kids, this might be it. You know, a lot of them aren't going to go on and play college or play professionally. So I try to keep that in mind and remember how important it is and how special it is for them.
Maureen Mullen still reports on the big leagues from time to time, but sometimes the best stories are closer to home. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Shortly after birth, I was found alone.
That's Andrew Peterson, a 22-year-old runner from Indiana.
I went to a foster home and was later adopted. My birth mother drank alcohol during pregnancy, and since I have brain damage from fetal alcohol syndrome, nothing in life has ever been easy.
Last year at the Special Olympics USA Games, Andrew Peterson won 3 gold medals in the 1500, 3000, and 5000 meters. He's also earned 4 varsity letters at his high school, and over the past year and a half, he has told his story in a speech, an excerpt of which you have just heard, at high schools throughout Indiana. Reporter Dana Hunzinger Benbow recently wrote about Andrew and his father, Craig, for the Indianapolis Star. The Petersons and Dana joined me from WFYI in Indianapolis, and I asked Craig what condition Andrew was in physically at the age of 5 when he adopted Andrew and his 3 siblings.
The first time meeting Andrew, he had this big smile on his face, and he didn't say a word. And I thought in the back of my head, oh, did I miss something? He doesn't talk. And eventually he grunted a few words, and I had no idea what he was saying. Likes to smile, seems eager to please, was pretty awkward. So I knew we had a lot of things to work on.
When he was first came to Craig, he had been called the Tin Man in his foster home because he was so stiff and didn't have that smooth gait.
Craig, when did you first begin to realize that Andrew might have a knack for running?
When we were at the Indianapolis Zoo, we were there on many Saturday mornings, and Andrew would be walking so fast in front of his siblings and me. I kept saying, Andrew, slow down. Come on now. And I would turn my back, and he'd be gone. And so I knew that there was some energy there.
Let's hear some more from Andrew Peterson's speech.
After a decade of physical therapy, I could finally move my arms and legs together in a smooth motion. I wasn't the fastest kid on the playground. But you know what? No one could run as far as me.
Andrew followed his older sister and joined his middle school's cross-country team. Dana, can you tell us the story of his first sixth-grade meet?
He was a tiny, tiny little sixth grader, and his dad said that he was so little that they had to find a singlet to fit him, but it was still falling off of him. And some of the coaches hadn't believed in him and worried that he couldn't do this. And he ended up coming in second, right, out of all 30. And that's when Craig said that he was like, okay, now we really need to work on this. So they started running on the weekends and really putting a lot of effort into it. And he just became an amazing athlete.
Andrew, what do you like about running?
I like to meet lots of new people and be successful.
Craig, it must have been incredibly exciting to discover after the struggles that you'd gone through with this child that he was incredibly good at something.
Bill, I think that's a key message for all your listeners is that all children, regardless of their abilities, have something they're good at. And what made it special for Andrew was that I was a runner in junior high and high school. So having one of my children want to do something that I like to do, that made it even more fun.
And you beat him now, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, a month ago we ran a 5K together, or I should say we started the 5K together, and we ran maybe the first 10 meters together, and I saw Andrew about 30 minutes later at the finish line.
Sipping a cold drink and wondering where you'd been. As I mentioned earlier, Andrew now tells his story at high schools across Indiana. Craig, what's it like when he comes to the podium to deliver his speech?
All of a sudden, all the side conversations stop and people listen.
Let's listen in once more.
I don't ever want your pity. Rather, I need your respect. The respect that all people with disabilities deserve.
You can link to Dana Hunzinger Benbow's story, Indie Athlete Prevails Over Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, at onlyagame.org. Dana, Craig, and Andrew, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, Bill.
Thank you.
Coming up on Only a Game, an examination of a question sports fans have been asking each other for years.
Who let the dogs out?
But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I can't listen to any version of that song except Mitt Romney's, who sang it in 2008, especially the woof woof part.
Some have referred to Tuesday night's All-Star Game as the Mike Trout Show, since Trout was the game's MVP for the second year in a row. Others have called it the Pete Rose Show. What do you think?
I would go with the Mike Trout Show, because outside of Mike Trout, the game was pretty much a dead fish in terms of ratings and everything else.
Ooh, Trout, fish, nicely done.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Piscatorial puns are my profession. Anyway, it was odd because everyone appeared to enjoy the revamped Home Run Derby the night before. Mm-hmm. And then the game just died. I mean, ratings-wise and everything else. And, of course, there wasn't any announcement one way or the other on Pete Rose. So,
in fact, the ratings were the worst that an All-Star game has ever had. I wonder if having the home field advantage in the World Series hinge on the outcome of the All-Star game has actually made it less popular.
I don't know why it would, and I'm reluctant to ascribe cause and effect there, but it certainly hasn't done them any good.
I can say that I enjoyed the SI.com article presenting the best All-Stars ever because I flipped immediately to the page where the author awarded center field to Willie Mays. Otherwise, I would not have read the article, let alone mentioned it to you.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things. Apparently, they couldn't squeeze Stan Musial in except as a designated hitter. Mm. And the left-handed pitcher, of all the people you can think of as left-handed pitchers, Lefty Gomez is their left-handed pitcher.
Speaking of Sports Illustrated, the magazine produced 25 separate covers for its July 20 issue, one for each of the members of the U.S. women's soccer team, an even more significant precedent than the ticker tape parade in New York.
That is really terrific of Sports Illustrated. I give them a seated ovation for that. They've done, like, mixed covers before, but that's just a really nice thing
to do.
It's
fun.
And it's happening in the middle of the summer where nothing else is really going on, so you can have a little fun with your cover.
Charlie, since we last spoke, Serena Williams has won yet another major tennis tournament, Wimbledon, again. This has led some to call her the greatest female tennis player ever. Others have called her the greatest female athlete ever. And one writer has said she's the most important athlete since Muhammad Ali in terms of her impact on the culture at large. All of the above?
No, the last one is silly and we shouldn't. I mean, I don't know what Serena Williams' impact on the culture at large has been. You know there's no bigger Steffi Graf fan on the planet than me. But the numbers are starting to become undeniable. She's certainly the best women's tennis player who ever lived. She's the best female athlete alive right now, for certain.
On Monday, Florida State University President John Thrasher met with members of the football team, whose numbers have recently been dwindling, by the way. What did President Thrasher have to say?
Stay out of bars, you dummies! Bad things happen there.
Go home.
Yeah, they're basically banning them from going to bars because it turns out that every time a Florida State football player goes to a bar, something bad happens and he gets suspended or expelled.
Or arrested,
or both, actually.
Or all of the above. Alabama's head football coach Nick Saban suggested this week that the NFL should hold off releasing their draft grades until the college football season has ended. According to one of the coach's former players, that was a little hypocritical. I send you now to the Twitter feed of one Plaxico Burress.
Yes, who played for Nick Saban back in Nick Saban's formative years at Michigan State. And he claims that Saban wanted him to stay in school rather than go into the draft. My favorite tweet in response is, "Now Nick Saban players are being distracted by the NFL and chasing a dream. Ha ha. Ha! Tell your story, Nick. LSU showed you $2 signs. You was gone. Ha! I love the fact that he ran out of characters. He can only have one ha at the end.
And only $2 signs. Last weekend, San Antonio Spurs assistant coach Becky Hammon became the first woman to coach an NBA Summer League game. How long before she's wielding her clipboard at an NBA regular season game?
She's on the track. She's certainly working in the best, as we've seen from their incredible performance in NBA free agency, she's working in the best possible operation to hone her skills. I would have bet anybody that if we do have a female head coach in the NBA, she will somehow have some connection with the operation that is the San Antonio Spurs. They're just a brilliant franchise.
On Wednesday, Dan Flynn, the Secretary General of the U.S. Soccer Federation, told members of a U.S. Senate subcommittee, quote, "I knew nothing about any corruption within FIFA." I wonder if any of the senators followed up by asking, "Did you go to any FIFA meetings?"
No, but to his credit, he, quote, "was aware of some level of discomfort."
Discomfort.
"But it was all a general feeling. I had no hard evidence." Nobody knew anything about this. This is great.
Changes to the National Baseball Association playoffs are coming, Charlie. It says so right here in this story from Rapid News Network.
It says so twice.
Right. Why change baseball? It's already great, right?
I prefer a nice vinegar and oil to baseball, but...
A typo is one thing. There it is again. And finally, in recognition that the Tour de France is currently underway, I present this tweet from famous and infamous champion slash ex-champion Lance Armstrong. Regarding the leaders, Mr. Armstrong opined, "Too strong to be clean? Don't ask me. I have no clue." Is there anything more to say than, "Okay, Lance, I won't"?
Listen, athletes of the world, Twitter is not your friend. Get off Twitter now. Lance Armstrong, "Don't ask me. I have no clue. I didn't know I was cheating."
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. And, of course, he joins me each week right here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
How about a nice game of baseball, Bill?
I'm ready. There are questions in life, and certainly some of them are set in sports, and perhaps none of those is as poignant and as deep as the one you'll hear in lots of sports stadia.
Who let the dogs out?
15 years ago, the Baja Men released the song that would tear up the charts in several countries and become a staple at sporting events the world over. Ben Ryder wrote about the Baja Men in Where Are They Now?, a column for Sports Illustrated. Ben, tell us how the song, which is now almost universally known, was almost lost to obscurity.
Someone went into the office of a record producer named Steve Greenberg. The guy's name was Fat Jack, and his band was called Fat Jack and His Pack of Pets. He played the song for Steve Greenberg, and he said this was one of the worst songs he'd ever heard in his whole life. Something about the song's hook, however, stuck with him.
By the way, depending on your musical taste, Greenberg is either a hero or a villain. He also produced this 1997 Hanson hit. I think that's about enough of that. Anyway, Greenberg got the Baja Men into the studio. They are talented musicians, but they had a problem with one thing at the recording session. What was that?
One of the problems was none of the Baja Men could bark up to Steve Greenberg's specifications. So on the record, when you hear the barking, that's Steve Greenberg himself leading the way. Steve Greenberg likes to say that he has produced two of the most despised songs in history between Umbop and Who Let the Dogs Out.
When the single was released, Greenberg hired a marketer. Normally, that person's job would be to push radio stations to play the song. But Greenberg had something else in mind. What was the strategy and how did it work?
He envisioned fans across the country singing this song in stadiums. So what he did was he hired a marketer named Fred Traub to go to the stadium directors of each stadium across the professional sports landscape with this song and say, "Hey, you guys got to listen to this. Your fans are going to love it. Your players are going to love it." The first team to bite on this in the year 2000 were the Seattle Mariners. Their stadium director, a guy named Greg Green, put the song on as a joke accompanying the at-bat of a country western catcher named Joe Oliver. Played it one time, then another player on the Mariners said, "You know what? I want you to play that song as my at-bat music." Mm-hmm. That player was Alex Rodriguez. A-Rod was really the one who first made this song popular.
The title of your article claims that this song, quote, forever changed music's place in sports. Is that a little marketing there, or is that claim legitimate?
I think that claim is legitimate. It used to be that stadium entertainment directors would simply pick whatever song was popular at the time and play it. This is the first time that recording companies would directly market songs to arenas. This is a big business that did not exist before Who Let the Dogs Out.
My understanding is that the actual subject of the song is a disagreement at a club. So what makes it so popular at stadiums, you think?
Right. Well, if you listen closely to the lyrics, it's really about women in a club looking at men and saying, these no good men are back, what are they up to? Nobody listens to the lyrics. You listen to the infectious beat. You listen to the barking. It's widely appealing to kids. It has its sports element in there because it's such a great stadium song. And it has everyone's favorite pet, dogs. Those three things, it checks all of those boxes. It was really a viral internet phenomenon before such a thing really existed.
Ben, Who Let the Dogs Out is the only sports anthem that the Baja Men have to date. Will it remain as popular as it has been over the last 15 years?
You know, it seems that way. In some ways, it's one of the most famous songs of all time. I went down to the Bahamas to watch them perform this song before a crowd of 20,000 people at something called the Junkanoo Carnival in Nassau, Bahamas. 15 years later, 20,000 people were still barking along to this song. This is something that will never die.
You can link to Ben Reiter's essay column, How Who Let the Dogs Out Forever Changed Music's Place in Sports, by visiting onlyagame.org. Ben, thanks very much. This has been fun.
Thanks, Bill.
Win three world championships in most sports, and people will probably know your name. Win three world championships in disc golf, and people might still be asking you, what's disc golf? For the record, it's a lot like regular golf, but instead of golf balls and holes, it uses frisbee-like discs and metal baskets. Reporter Liz Reed recently met up with Red Whittington as he prepares to compete for his fourth disc golf world championship.
I'll be 63 when the tournament starts.
Oh, so you have a birthday coming up.
Yeah, my birthday is August 2nd. And I've gotten three real good birthday presents so far, so I'm working on a fourth. I want to bring back another title to Pittsburgh, also known as the City of Champions.
I'm speaking with Red Whittington in his home in Pittsburgh. He's just finished his morning workout with his personal trainer. While he drinks his second vegan protein smoothie of the day, he shows me trophies from his past titles and a framed promotional poster from the 1976 World Frisbee Championships.
When I saw the World Championships on the ABC Wide World of Sports in 1976, it was a life-changing event for me. I said to myself, I want to be a world champion. You know, they say follow your heart. That's where my heart is. I put my heart and soul into it. At the time in Pittsburgh, I didn't know any other players that were as dedicated as I was, and I wanted to be as good as I could. So I decided to move down to Sarasota, Florida. I didn't know anybody there. Packed my bicycle in a box and took a Greyhound bus down there and just showed up. And I was introduced to disc golf down there in the summer of 1980. So I've been playing disc golf for 35 years and throwing the disc about 47 years. And then I moved back to Pittsburgh, and eventually we got the Parks and Recreation interested in a disc golf course. And I've been playing that course. That's been my home course for 27 years. Rough estimate, I played 5,000 rounds there.
Red took me to his home course in Schenley Park. From the hill we're on, we can see that it's raining downtown, but the weather is holding for us for now.
Well, I'm here on the tee. I'm looking at the basket. It's approximately about 275 feet. It looks like it's flat, but I'm actually throwing a little bit uphill. It levels out, and then it goes up the hill. So this is a tricky shot. I don't birdie this hole that often. And by birdie, I'm saying if I make it in two shots, because this is a par three hole.
Red has a lot to consider before taking his shot. He has to pick the right disc, gauge the wind direction and elevation change, and choose his approach.
Oh, it looks like a beauty. Look at that. It's right under the basket. I can't believe it. It's exactly the way I imagined it. putting is really the key. No one ever won a world title that wasn't a good putter.
Relax, focus, confident, commit.
But some of these guys can throw twice as far as I do. But guess what? When they get up to the basket and say they're 20 feet away, that 20-foot shot counts just as much as that 500-foot toss they just did. I always like to quote Shakespeare, "The putter is mightier than the driver." Back in the day, I went to 10 world championships in a row. I toured a lot until 1999, and I took some time off. I thought, you know what, I'll just be as good as I used to be, and I'll be fine. But guess what? Everybody is so much better now.
Red says his father sponsored him for much of his disc golf career, and he worked for 40 years as a waiter until he injured his non-throwing elbow carrying heavy trays of food. 5 years ago, Red was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, a condition that causes his heart to sometimes beat irregularly and rapidly. He had it under control with medication until the lead-up to this year's World Championships.
Just in the past couple of weeks, I went to the emergency room twice. I actually had to withdraw from a tournament I was in. After the first round, I was in the lead. I really did not want to leave, but I decided it'd be better for me to go to the emergency room, get this checked out. I managed to play well, even though I was in that state, AFib, for at least an hour, hour and a half before the round was over.
So with the World Championships coming up in less than a month, Red decided to have a surgical procedure that he hopes will cure his condition.
I was going to postpone this until after the World Championships because I didn't want my training routine interrupted. I'll have to rest up for a whole week after that procedure, but hopefully if everything goes all right, I'll still have 2 more weeks to train for the World Championships. I think my chances are good. Physically, even though I'm going into the hospital for a procedure next week, I'm in pretty good physical shape. I'll show up on the day of the tournament when it starts, and I'll say, you know what? I deserve to win this more than anybody else because I've trained harder than anybody else. I'm not saying I'm going to win, but I intend to win, and I'm going to keep my eye on that prize.
Reporter Liz Reed of 90.5 WESA in Pittsburgh spoke with Red Whittington 3 days before his heart surgery. His doctor ordered a full week of rest, but this weekend he's back to league play with the Pittsburgh Flying Disc Society. The Professional Disc Golf Association World Championships will be held in Pittsburgh during the first week in August. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. Our intern is Joe Jacobs. We had help this week from Marquise Neal and from John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from a breed of sports philosopher well known to stadium goers.
Who let the dogs out?
Close it, close it, gate it. Ah, it's too late. I'm Bill Littlefield. We'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. And thank you for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives now and for generations to come, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at WTGrantFoundation.org.